Terry Williams.
Good morning. Thomas Kemmerer from the Washington Appella Project on behalf of Kerry Williams, and I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I've raised a number of issues in the briefing, and I want to focus on one, particularly the failure of the trial court to grant a mistrial in this case. And if the court has no questions on the other issues that I've raised, I'm going to submit those on my brief. Hearing no questions, the trial court here found that much of the prosecutor's conduct here was fodder for cross-examination by the defense, but they were denied that opportunity once the uncle fled. But, in fact, the trial court even found that some of the information may have been Brady material. But the trial court decided solely to strike the testimony and any evidence that flowed from the uncle. The trial court refused to grant a mistrial. If you look at the evidence that the uncle brought to trial, it was incredibly powerful evidence. It was the most powerful evidence about this young girl being born, cataloging her birth in the Bible, talking about the death or the fact that her mother fled, her father raised her, her father's death, the fact that she ended up in an orphanage. He brought the Bible, which listed all the facts about the family. Incredibly powerful evidence. Yet the trial court didn't grant a mistrial.
Wasn't the motion presented in the alternative? To either grant mistrial or strike the testimony. They said, I agree, I'm going to strike the testimony.
Initially, that was the motion. But at the close of evidence, Ms. Williams' attorney moved for a mistrial and said there was no way to cleanse the taint that was brought to the trial by this evidence. And if you look at the conduct of the prosecutor here, it was pretty egregious. It was never disclosed. It was the prosecutor providing funds. Granted, it was for a meal or for clothes, Goodwill or such. A lot of this before his testimony, after the uncle's testimony, the fact that the prosecutor went to the uncle's hotel room, gathered up his possessions, took them home, didn't provide them to the police for another 3 days. This is conduct that was pretty darn egregious, and it was never disclosed. The defense had to find out about it, and yet the trial court didn't grant a mistrial. I think it was incredibly powerful evidence, and the trial court should have granted a mistrial.
When you read the cross-examination of the alleged cousin, doesn't there seem to be a lot of doubt about his recollection? Wasn't he impeached on almost every date that he offered, and confusion from prior statements?
Oh, absolutely. So absolutely. He wasn't.
How does that cut, then, in your argument?
He wasn't a great witness, but this provided even further fodder. The fact that he was brought to this country and there was some interesting things going on in the background in order to keep him here, keep him satisfied, keep him on track to testify, I think that makes it even stronger that a mistrial should have been granted, given his testimony. Hearing no further questions, I will just save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have 6 minutes.
May it please the court, my name is Eric Peterson from the Skagit County Prosecutor's Office. And I think we have to recognize that the trial court, its decision here is reviewed for abuse of discretion on what remedy to grant. As was pointed out, the remedy that was requested initially was, and from my perspective was maintained throughout the course of the trial, was the remedy seeking just an alternative remedy seeking striking of the testimony and or mistrial. And the court chose the remedy to strike the testimony. And I think this is relevant and important for this particular reason. The reason the trial court chose to strike the testimony was once the information was provided and it was shared, the defense did not have an opportunity to go back and contact and question the witness again. They couldn't come back and say and try to impeach his credibility further by showing any benefits that would have been provided. Now, had he been available, they would have had that opportunity and been in a position where that would have been contested. They could have developed that. But was because he was not available was the problem that made the trial court choose to strike the testimony. Had it been available, they would have had a chance to put all these facts before the jury. Now, the method in which the state found out about whether or not he had remained, because there was an obligation that the elected prosecutor had, which was to keep the individual available and to be returned after the testimony was through. Now, you don't have the law enforcement looking over this individual, because that's not the type of situation that you can put someone under arrest for.
Excuse me. Was he excused as a witness?
Yes. I mean, he was through with his testimony. And so he was done, but then it was found out that he had left. He was not staying with the prosecutor any longer, and the prosecutor initially wasn't assuming that he'd automatically, that he'd make himself completely unavailable and not return. So he didn't initially disclose the information because it didn't pertain to his testimony, which had already happened. But once it was determined that then he didn't surrender himself to return to his home country, then the issue becomes whether or not there is more motive on behalf of this witness that the defense was then entitled to question about. And I don't think the prosecutor really disagreed with that reasoning by the trial court at that level, but it was because they didn't have the chance to go back and further impeach this witness with the additional fact that he'd fled, that the trial court made the decision to strike the testimony altogether. And again, the trial court, having heard the testimony, evaluated that testimony in light of all the cross-examination of the witness and the context of the other evidence, chose the remedy to strike the testimony. And the jury is presumed to follow the court's decision and ruling to strike testimony if that's ordered. If there are any questions on that particular issue, I'd be glad to answer any questions that the court have with respect to the other issues before the court. Is there any particular interest?
I had a question about the term torture. On the one hand, the cases say that it's an easily understood common sense term, and if that's true, why was there a need for any expert testimony to explain to the jury what torture was? That seems to me somewhat inconsistent.
I can see how you could see that to be incongruous, but I think the difference is, in this particular case, it's each individual act as it occurred was not by itself one act which you could perceive as resulting in torture. Certain acts, individual acts, striking the bottom of the feet apparently is a really painful way to torture someone. That's not necessarily what's the common knowledge, that is a prolonged impact on an individual. But the deprivation of food, having someone required to shower outside, be soaked down with water out and hosed down outside, required to stay inside a small closet to sleep, those things maybe individually wouldn't seem like but the constellation of them led the trial court to, the state contends, properly conclude that torture was an issue that experts would be assistants of, and just the general understanding of torture would need further explanation. The problem is, I understand the court questioning as well, if that's the case, and as applied in this particular case, isn't a further definition of torture needed? And the state's position is that no, and because you have this information, which was essentially unrebutted from the defense, that these things amount to torture, that the trial court wasn't required to provide an additional instruction as to further define torture.
As to the exclusion of Dr. Bartlett's testimony, the trial court doesn't appear to have gone through the Hutchinson factors. Do we need the trial court to go through those factors?
I pointed that out in my brief, that there's no absolute requirement that the trial court go through the Hutchinson factors. And I think the court needs to be very careful when you're looking at the Hutchinson case for impact on all subsequent cases. Now, Hutchinson was a case where the defendant had refused to participate in an evaluation by the state's experts to be able to counteract an examination by the defense. So basically the defense would have had their whole theory of the case in, and the state would have not had an opportunity. And it was done pre-trial that occurred. So there was a continuance could have been granted to take some steps. But that was, as opposed to the present situation, here this happened mid-trial that the information came out. Now, Hutchinson does have the four factors to evaluate, and I think there's no absolute requirement that the trial court do a weighing of each of the factors on the record, but I think enough of a weighing is evident from the ruling of the trial court here for the court to conclude that the trial court did not use its discretion in excluding the witness. Now, this is one thing that's important. I don't think it was – I tried to highlight it in my brief. We have this dental expert, Dr. Bartling, but it wasn't him who did the testing. Someone else did this radiocarbon testing, which didn't even start until after the trial started. And the state was led enough in a position of trying to respond mid-trial to a situation where another individual, who was apparently an expert, was giving information to Dr. Bartling to present to the jury. So it's like a two-level expert, and we didn't have a chance to go back and even evaluate under a Frye standard the analysis done by Dr. Buchholz to provide a Bartling to have Bartling testify. So when this came
up, continuance a day or so provided the state with a means of addressing that evidence?
If you're talking about a fact witness, where there's a limited amount of information you can evaluate, I think that's
an expert witness here, right?
I don't think that's an adequate period of time for the state to be able to respond to an expert witness brought up mid-trial on an issue which, in the end, the witness, and go back to what the defense represented initially with respect to what Dr. Bartling would testify, that the child couldn't have been under age 15 and the range was up to 20. When the actual information was gathered by the state, the range of the age was 13 to 19 by this radiocarbon testing, which was consistent with the range that all the other experts had provided, both the state and defense. So you also have the issue here of cumulativeness of the fact of this item of evidence. So given the constellation of the circumstance, I think the trial court made a proper decision to exclude the witness, given the timing which was disclosed, and the time available mid-trial was not adequate to deal with an expert of a unique issue.
On the mistrial issue, did the defense propose any type of limiting instruction?
You mean the mistrial for the issue with respect to
Waldestick's
testimony?
Yes.
I don't believe that they proposed that type of instruction. Now, again, I'm going to defer to the record on that. But
we'll hear from Mr. Camaro on that.
Pardon?
If you don't know, we can hear from Mr.
Yeah, my recollection was that it's not there, but if that's something that means a difference in the court's decision, I'd ask you to refer to the record on that point. If there are any other issues the court would like me to address, hearing none, I would ask the court affirm the convictions in this case, both for Hannah Williams and Emmanuel Williams, for homicide by abuse and assault in the first degree. Thank you.
Thank you.
Judge Lowen, let me answer your question. There was a whole instruction that the court gave after she struck the uncle's testimony.
I understand, but did the defense propose any language related to a limiting instruction?
I don't think there was specific language proffered by the defense. I think there was a discussion that went on among everyone, the judge, the parties, about what would happen. And I think even if there is an instruction, look at Escalona, look at Sulawesi. Those are cases where they gave an instruction, and the court of and in Sulawesi, the court of appeals even affirmed based on that fact that juries are presumed to follow the instructions. Yet the Supreme Court said there are some cases where the instruction just cannot cleanse the taint.
But there's no evidence here that the jury didn't follow the court's instruction.
But But that was...
Is that right?
Yes, but that was the case in those cases as well. The presumption was, yes, the jury followed the instruction. But you don't know because you can't go into the jury room. You can't find out what the jury thought, what they talked about, whether this was even discussed. I mean, that's part of the problem here. So based on that, I don't think an instruction really would have benefited anybody. The taint was so strong, and it's much stronger than the taint that was in Escalona and Zaleski as well. You look at the powerful evidence of, or the powerful testimony that this individual brought. Talking about the mistrial motion is on the August 28, 2013 report of proceedings at pages 6 and 7, where Ms. Williams' attorney asked for a mistrial based on the uncle's testimony. Bartolink is an interesting issue. The state says we didn't know about Bartolink until the last minute, which is not the case. There was discussions about Bartolink in pretrial, and there was a whole discussion about him getting the evidence and what he would do with the evidence. So to say we didn't know about Bartolink is wrong. They knew about Bartolink, but the assumption at that point was we don't know if he's going to testify. We know roughly what he's going to do and what his result is going to be, but we don't know if he's going to testify. It was only once the uncle testified that the defense decided to call Bartolink. But
did
Bartolink...
Kerry Williams' attorneys ever list Bartolink at the August 23rd hearing? They indicated we're now giving notice we would like to present a supplemental witness list. Did they ever present a supplemental witness list?
They did not. They did not. They joined in Mr. Williams' request to have Bartolink testify. Because he had not listed Bartolink as a witness, but in the supplemental, that was one of the things that was brought up, is they listed Bartolink as a new witness.
If we have to look at willfulness under the Hutchison factors, isn't it willful, intentional anyway, to know in January that this individual is proposing certain testing using teeth related to age, and then say, well, we're going to wait and see how things play out, and then wait and wait and wait, and then finally get the green light, the testing at the Livermore Laboratories, and then you're well into the trial before you get the results, and then, boom, here we want to now call this individual who was taken off the witness list?
There's two problems with that. First of all, the trial court didn't make a finding of willfulness, so we've got that issue. The other issue is it didn't become clear that they would need to have Bartolink testify until later, because remember the uncle's testimony, or the fact that the uncle was going to be a witness, came fairly late, too. That was not something that was known by the parties all the way up until trial. It was just before trial that the uncle was listed as a witness. So he was late. His announcement of being a witness was late as well. So although the defense had given Bartolink had obtained the teeth and had started to do the process to test, he didn't test until he was given the green light by the defense that they really needed his evidence.
By Larry Williams.
Exactly. And the discussion about, well, he's relying on evidence that, or he's relying on testing that he didn't do, he proffered several declarations pointing out that this is something that he's aware of, he engages in, he didn't do it here. And there's frequently cases where an expert relies on somebody else's either testing or reports or something like that. So that's not unusual if that would happen in an expert situation. And if the court has no further questions, we would just ask that Ms. Williams' convictions be reversed and remanded for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you.